problems. And so apologetics is a ministry of caring for people by giving them answers to objections against some aspect of Christianity and providing reasons for Christianity. So it's responding to objections and providing reasons. To my knowledge, I've been in the ministry now 49 years, and I've never seen a period of time when it's less practiced in the church and more needed. I was in Seattle several years ago and had spoken at a retreat for the weekend. I was flying back Sunday morning, and I made a beeline for the Seattle Times and took a look at the editorial page. And the lead editorial, which was syndicated, so it went all over the country, but it was actually a page and a half long, was called A Divided Nation. Covers the front page and then half the second page. Significant space given to this editorial. The author said that we now live in the most divided period in the history of America, apart from the Civil War. And I think it's gotten worse since he wrote that. But what was extremely insightful was what he claimed was the fundamental dividing point among the American people. Tremendous, it was good. He said, the thing that divides us is not politics. Well, you could have fooled a lot of people on that, because we are deeply divided politically. It's not socioeconomic. It's not ethnic or racial. It's not gender, however many there are these days. And it has nothing to do with social status or social class. These are all symptoms of a deeper divide. The fundamental divide among the American people, he said, is a divide over worldview. And he said there are two fundamental worldviews. He was wrong about that. You can't blame him. He's only a professor of political science, and not a philosopher, bless his heart. But the fundamental divide, he said, is over people who are secularized and people who believe in a moral monotheism, that there is a creator God who gave us the moral law and to whom we're responsible. Now, this division has created a situation where, for the first time in the history of Christianity, not only is Christianity considered to be superstitious and kind of stupid and foolish, but it's also considered to be immoral. Up until the 1950s, the teachings of Jesus, whether that you thought Jesus was the Son of God or not, were considered to be a good moral standard for people to seek to achieve. Now, the teachings of Jesus and the scriptures are considered to be bigoted, homophobic, and more or less a white man's religion. And we are considered to be stupid bigots by most people. Novelist Jane Smiley put it this way: here's how their ignorance and bigotry works. I'm speaking about you and me. First, they put the fear of God into you. If you don't believe in the literal word of the Bible, you'll burn in hell. Of course, the literal word of the Bible is tremendously contradictory. So you have to abdicate critical thinking to be a Christian and accept a simple system of belief that you're not allowed to question. A corollary to this point is they make sure you understand that Satan resides in the toils and snares of complex thought. So it's best not to try to think at all. So in other words, our attitude is that if you get too educated, you're going to lose your faith. There's something dangerous about graduate school and graduate degrees and learning, because Christianity is a very simple religion. It doesn't involve complex thought, and people who get wrapped up in that are into a head trip. Okay. That's why we don't have models for our kids who would like to grow up and be the smartest economics scholars in the country for the kingdom, or to grow up and be the best journalist or chemical engineer or what it is for the kingdom. That is not a vision. If they're going to become Christians, they'll be a youth director or play worship music or perhaps go in the mission field if they're really committed. But what the mission field needs are serious teachers that will help these hundreds of thousands of converts learn about their faith instead of syncretizing it with what they already have in their culture. Now, I remember old Robert Reich. He was the Secretary of Labor with the Clinton administration, taught, and I don't know if he still teaches at Harvard. Here's something he said that should take your breath away. So listen, try to listen carefully to this. He said, the great conflict of the 21st century will not be between the West and terrorism. Whoa, dude, man. Terrorism is a tactic. It's not a belief. The true battle of the 21st century will be between modern civilization and anti-modernists, between those who believe in the primacy of the individual and those who believe that human beings owe their allegiance and identity to a higher power, between those who give priority to life in this world and those who believe that human life is a mere preparation for an existence beyond the grave, between those who believe in science, reason, and logic, and those who believe the truth is revealed through scripture and religious dogma. Terrorism will disrupt and destroy our lives, but terrorism is not the greatest danger we face. Conservative religion is. Now, do you understand what's being said here? That we are now considered to be an extreme danger to American culture. Because not only are we ignorant, we can't speak into the public square intelligently, and when we do, the only thing we can do is quote the Bible, and our views are outdated, outmoded, and extremely embarrassing and backward. And I don't take this to be true, although I think there's some truth to this characterization of us. But that's the view that is held by at least 28% of the leading people who shape our culture, including university professors, and on it goes. You go to an average university, and in any discipline, there's about 15 liberals to one conservative in that university. And that's because there are two kinds of universities, according to the leading expert on this, who teaches at New York University, and he gave a lecture at Duke. He said there are tens of thousands of hours of research have shown there are social justice universities and truth universities. 90% of our universities are social justice universities. Their goal is to achieve social justice, dismantle white privilege, and to bring diversity and social justice to disempowered groups. Those campuses have 20 to 1 liberals to conservatives. If a conservative speaker comes on campus, there's a riot or he's shouted down and can't speak. And the kids who graduate from those schools don't know anything. They're babies, they're adolescents, because they've been pampered. Donald Trump came to speak at one of those schools and have the first debate with Hillary Clinton. And the campus had 4 different organizations that had healing and comfort rooms for students that were traumatized by Trump's presence on the campus, where they could go get donuts and refreshments. They could be, have back rubs, be soothed. Now, if that's what's coming out of Berkeley in those schools, they are people who do not know how to interact civilly with others that have a different view. Now, the other are truth universities. There are about 5 to 10% of American colleges and their aim is to equip students to reason well so they can come to understand what the truth is. about any subject. There are 5 liberals to 4 conservatives, and they welcome speakers with a variety of viewpoints and give them a chance to give their case. And those kids are fairly mature when they grow up and know how to think well. So the issue before us then is that we Christians are increasingly being marginalized by a worldview struggle that has now been able to succeed against us to the point that we are being caricatured and in some ways actually accurately so in the public square. Now, I will tell you quickly the 3 worldviews and what they have in common, the 2 of them, and then I'll try to do a little equipping here. By far the dominant worldview in Western culture and in the United States is scientific naturalism. Scientific naturalism. This view has fundamentally 2 commitments. The first commitment is the physical world is all there is. And everything that exists is a collection of atoms and molecules just arranged in different ways. So that you are a conglomeration of atoms and molecules structured differently than the structure of the atoms and molecules that constitute a dog or a rock or anything else. Just you have different chemicals. There's no soul, no consciousness is not, consciousness is nothing but brain states, and so on. The second principle is that the only way, or at least by far the best way to know reality, is through the hard sciences. If you can prove something in chemistry and physics and neuroscience perhaps, or biology, you can know it's real. But if you can't, if it's not a claim made in the hard sciences, then it's an expression of emotion or personal choice, and no one can know who's right or wrong because politics, political claims, religious claims, ethical claims, claims in the humanities, and maybe even claims in the soft sciences, like psychology, and poor education doesn't know what it is. It's got physics envy. It's trying to quantify everything, which in my opinion is destroying kids. But in any case, you have to understand that the only knowledge that you can gain of reality is in the sciences. The doctor has authority and the pastor doesn't in the community. And the difference is the doctor actually knows something. Ministers don't know anything. They have a set of personal feelings and beliefs that they share with a community of people who are needy and need that sort of thing. But they have nothing to say that's knowledge-based. So Time Magazine, a few years ago, had a cover story, how the world would end. And it was on the cover, how the universe would end. And you go inside and the article said, for millennia, human beings have wanted to know how all this would end. Unfortunately, for all that time, the only place they could turn to was religion and philosophy, which amount to nothing but idle speculation. Now, that was itself a philosophical statement, which would in turn be nothing but idle speculation in order to be consistent with the view being presented. But consistency is the hobgoblin of little minds, I suppose. But in any case, the article concluded, now for the first time in human history, science has moved in to this area of human inquiry, and for the first time we now know answers to our questions. So science gives knowledge. Religion and philosophy and ethics and all that give beliefs. That feel real important. Now, the next worldview is postmodern relativism, and you find postmodernism largely in sociology departments, English literature departments, anthropology departments, and communication departments. It's elsewhere, but those are the four main culprits. If you have a kid that goes to college, don't let him major in sociology. It was started by August Comte, an atheist. He began planting churches of atheism, and it has the highest percentage of faculty that are atheists of any discipline in the universities. And they target theistic believers to try to destroy their faith. Sociology is a pit of hell, even at Biola University. Our sociology department is destroying Biola. And it started happening 2 years ago. And it is extremely dangerous what's going on at Biola and what's going on around the country. Enough of that. So this is the view that basically there's no such thing as a real world. We construct reality, and there's no truth or knowledge that's objective. We construct it. So there's no such thing as gender that's objectively out there. Instead, gender is whatever we say it is. We construct it to be. And so this is a form of relativism about reality and truth and values. Okay? Whatever's true for your group is fine and real. Whatever's true and real for another group is okay, and they're both right. So this fosters kind of a godless and moral tolerance, which means you're not supposed to say people are wrong, which is so evil, because that principle of tolerance silences the protest of evil. You can't protest against child molestation, because to do so, you have to first judge that's wrong. Well, if postmodernism is true, and you're not supposed to judge anything as wrong, that's intolerant, then you can't protest against evil. Plus, they don't practice it consistently. They only tolerate people who agree with their principle of tolerance. If you're not a person who agrees with their principle of tolerance, they don't tolerate you. So they're no different than anybody else. They tolerate the people they agree with, and they don't tolerate the people they don't agree with. By tolerate means agree with. Now, what is at issue here? In this church and in Christian colleges and homeschooling and Christian universities, the fundamental thing at issue today is not truth. No. Maybe it should be, but I don't know about that. The fundamental issue today for us, the third worldview is Christianity. The fundamental issue is Christianity true? The fundamental issue is, can we know Christianity is true? So the fundamental question that we're facing today is a question about the nature and limits of knowledge. Because I can go on a campus and say, Froggy Jesus jumped into my heart, and he changed my life, and the Bible tells me that I have eternal life. And I think it's true. And people will yawn, and, that was a nice little thing, I guess. If I go in there and say, not only is Christianity true, but you can actually know it's true, and so it's irrational not to believe it, that's like teeing off a golf ball in the shower. It comes right back at you pretty quickly. So what we are doing with our kids, according to a Navigator study, and this is why we're losing them, is we're telling them what to believe but not why. We're not giving them extra biblical evidence, not evidence from the Bible, but extra biblical evidence for why the Bible makes sense in the first place. Okay? So now, the fundamental issue is knowledge and not truth. Truth is a part of the package, but it goes deeper than that. It has to do with what you can know. Now, I'll take two, maybe three questions, and then just because of time, we probably need to move on. But is there someone who'd like to throw something or raise a question? Yeah, Logan.
Yeah, so you're saying that the scientific naturalism, that it's kind of the dominant worldview?
Yeah.
But the studies I've seen say that, like, atheism is at about 5%. So what do you mean by, like, the dominant?
Well, do you all believe DNA contains your genetic information?
Yeah.
Okay, that's false. The soul does. And most people would think I was crazy by saying that, but it's actually highly likely to be true. But people believe that DNA does because science has told them that. And science has authority. Do you believe animals have souls? Okay. The animals clearly have souls. And the church has taught that ever since the beginning of the church up until Descartes and Darwin. It was Darwin who destroyed belief in animal souls. Now, that the reason people...
A geologist.
The reason people don't believe animals have souls is because they, in the church, is because they don't know what a soul is or what it does. And the only thing they can think about what it does is, well, it goes to heaven when we die. And if you say animals have souls, you must be saying they're in heaven when we die. They don't have anything else to what souls do. Because science has told them, that neuroscience has said that our memories are in our brains, which they're not. I heard the leading expert in the world on memory lecture at Biola. He teaches at UC Santa Barbara. Most published in the world on memory. First thing he says is, I have absolutely no idea what it means to say a memory's in your brain. I don't even know what it means. The memories aren't in the brain. The memories are in the self or the ego or the soul. And that's why near-death experiences, people take their memories with them, and they don't have brains. And also, all the brain has is certain things that can block one's ability to access memories. So the brain is just something you depend on to think while you're in your body. But the brain does. Now, we believe these things because they're what science says. And as a result, our beliefs in God and Christian teaching are extraordinarily weak. And so you don't have to be an atheist to believe this. What it does is it causes Christians to retreat and largely believe the atomic theory of matter and the scientific worldview as far as they can understand it, and then hold on to their Christian beliefs by an act of just kind of faith and social reinforcement. That's kind of what I'm saying. Yes?
If I understood correctly, you said that the fundamental 21st century war is between secularism and religious tradition. What do you think?
My mistake. Between secularism as manifested in naturalism and postmodernism, and ethical monotheism, the belief which Christianity is the main form.
That's what I meant. So what do you think about Dr. Rick Kennedy at Punahou Nazarene saying it's really between Islam and Christianity that the real war is happening?
No. Okay. I mean, worldwide there are problems, but not in Western culture.
Oh, you're talking about Western culture.
Yeah.
Okay.
Yeah. Europe can't defeat the Muslims because they were first secularized, which means that religion is nothing but a hobby. So they can't get people who don't think like Western people. Well, of course we can have Muslims come in here because religion is a privatized thing for them and it's kind of a hobby. They'll fit in. They don't get people who don't take their religion as a hobby. Because in a world dominated by naturalism, it is. Okay, now let me now define, I'm going to define truth, knowledge, and belief for you. And my goal is to say this. We need to be presenting to the world that in Scripture and in the great creeds and in the great books of the history of Christian theology and spirituality, we have a body of knowledge that we present to the world just like any other discipline. So the literature on spiritual formation ought to be treated as making knowledge claims about human functioning every bit as much as the literature in psychology. Because this is a body of knowledge, not privatized faith for people who already need that sort of thing. So we are not a faith community. We're a knowledge community. We always have been till the last 50-something years. So, what is truth? Define truth. Truth is when things are the way I take them to be. Truth is when things are the way I take them to be. Let me explain. Over here, Another way to define this, by the way, is truth is when things are the way I think them or believe them or say them to be. So truth is when things are the way I think them to be or believe them to be or say them to be. Okay? Now, how many things do you have to have in the room before it larger than can be in the room?
One more time.
How many things would need to be in this room before the relation larger than could obtain in the room?
One.
Not one. Nope. Because something can't be larger than itself. How many?
Two.
Yeah. This podium and this. You got to have two things for truth. Because truth is a relation like larger than. And what you need in order for truth to be said in this room is you have to have a truth maker. And a truth bearer. The truth maker is reality. And the truth bearer is a thought, a belief, or a proposition of some kind. A proposition is the content of a sentence or an utterance. Okay? So Schnee ist Weiss and Snow is White are different sentences with the same proposition or content. Snow is white. Okay. Now, if a thought goes through my mind and everybody in the world is blind, I'm walking across the street blind and a thought occurs to me that grass is green, and let's suppose that in that world grass actually is green. My thought is true, even though no one can tell whether or not it is true. But it's still true. I don't believe the thought. It just darted through my mind. But the thought is true because the thought matches reality. The thought matches reality. Okay, does that make sense to you? So truth is a matching between an assertion or a thought or belief and the real world. And that's truth. When we talk about the Bible being true, what we're saying is that when properly interpreted, what it asserts to be the case matches reality. That's what we mean. A false prophet is someone whose assertion fails to match reality. So truth is really kind of simple. How do I know that's the proper definition of truth? Somebody says, maybe that's just your definition. Your answer is to just give them a simple little case. So I get a call, I'll give them the bookstore case. I get a call in my office at the university, Prof. Moreland, the book you ordered by Richard Swinburne, Mind, Brain, and Free Will, it came in, you can get it. So I decide whether what they're telling me is true or not. I walk over to the bookstore, and suddenly my eyes fall on that book. And what happens then is I see the book. But I don't experience truth yet. I simply just have a sense experience of the book. But I stop and say, now what was my thought? It's that the book is in the bookstore. The book is in the bookstore. What's the relationship between these? Oh, the relationship that ties them together is matching. Or corresponding, or truth. I go home, my wife says, you're angry, and I don't believe her, so I go introspect, and I find the seething feeling in my chest. I take the thought, I'm angry, I compare it with reality, and I notice that thing again. What did I call that? Oh yeah, that's truth. So just start with cases, and truth is when a thought or a belief matches what's real. That's all you mean, even if you don't know it does. You're not saying you know this is true at this point, you're just saying what truth is. Now, what's knowledge? There are three kinds of knowledge. And all three are given to us by Christianity. Keep mind that clock. Your clocks go very fast. And I blame you for it. All right. First is knowledge. KW will stand for knowledge by direct experience. Almost nobody believes in this today, especially among the Christian College Coalition, sadly. Jamie Smith at Calvin College keeps chiding us at Biola for being a part of the Biola School, because we actually believe that our faculties allow us to make direct contact with the real world. What a country. as though that is some kind of wild claim. Anyway, knowledge by direct experience means that I'm just aware of something. I'm having knowledge by direct experience of this gentleman, and I'm having knowledge by direct experience of this. And I can have knowledge by acquaintance without having any concepts or thoughts in my mind or without using language. I might be aware of this, but not be aware that it's yellow, because I don't have a concept of yellow yet. Now, little children have knowledge by acquaintance before they have concept formation. But after repeated exposure to red things, they eventually form a concept of red. Then they can conceive of that color without it being present. And eventually they learn a word to express that concept inside them. And that's red. So we don't think in language. We think in thoughts. We use language to express our thoughts. Language is out in the world. Thoughts are inside the mind, not the brain. There's nothing but electrolyzed meat in your brain and synapses and firing. That's it. All your consciousness is in your soul. Okay. Animal's consciousness is in the animal soul. And knowledge by acquaintance is prior to being able to conceptualize or think about something. I can be aware of Uncle Harry's favorite clothing, a hat. I can just be aware of it, but I might not be aware yet that it's a hat, and I certainly might not know that it's Uncle Harry's favorite hat, but I'm still aware of it. Now, this goes beyond the five senses. You can be aware of what is going on inside of you by introspection, but you don't see anything. You can't see, touch, taste, smell, or hear thoughts or emotions or desires or beliefs, but you can be aware of them. If I say, what are you thinking right now? All you have to do is to turn inward, and you can be directly aware of your thoughts, but you can't see them. They're disgustingly invisible. Okay. God has thoughts. And so do angels, and they're not visible. Okay, so now, knowledge by acquaintance is not limited to the five senses. I've had times when I've been aware of demons. I know people who have been aware of angelic presences, and they did not. It was not through the five senses. It was a different kind of awareness. And I've had times when I've been aware that God showed up at a worship time where I've just been aware of his presence. I've sensed his presence. That is knowledge by acquaintance. I'm aware that he's there. Sometimes I don't sense his presence, but sometimes I do, and that's knowledge by acquaintance. Okay. The next kind of knowledge is really the most important, and this is called propositional knowledge. All this is a background to apologetics. Propositional knowledge is a true belief based on adequate grounds or reasons. All right. So if you know something, like that George Washington was the first president of the United States, or water's H2O, or God was in Christ reconciling himself, reconciling the world to himself, if you know that instead of just believe it, then you have it's true, You can't know something and then say, but it's not really true. If you found out that what you thought you knew turned out to be false, you would withdraw your claim to know it. You'd say, well, I thought I knew it, but apparently I was wrong. So if you know something, like there is a group of people in this room, the first thing that has to be the case is that your what you know must match reality. That's number one. But you can have the truth without knowing it, can't you? But you can't know something without it being true. So, if you know something, it's first of all got to be true, and secondly, you got to believe it. Now, what's a belief? A belief is a mental content, it's a content in your mind, you take to be true. A belief is a content in the mind you take to be true with a certainty between 51 and 100%. So a belief is a content in your mind that you take to be true, and your certainty of that is somewhere between 51 and 100%. So if you're 55-45 on something, you believe it, but it's pretty weak. Implication, as a Christian, you don't want to just assess what you believe. It's far more important to assess how strongly you believe things, and then try to find out how to bump 60-40 up to, say, 75-25. So there are many of you here in this room that don't actually believe God answers prayer because you prayed a lot and nothing happens. So you're probably 60-40 on that. You believe it, but not very, you don't rely on it real heavily. Well, there are ways of strengthening that. But belief is either between 51% or 100%. Now, adequate reasons means that you have got solid grounds or reasons for why you believe what you believe. And that's what apologetics does, is to try to provide these adequate grounds. To illustrate this, we have a guy down in Newport Beach who drinks 24/7. He just lives around the men's room there. And he's formed the habit of everything written on the second stall, he believes. His attitude is, the stall says it, I believe it, that settles it. So he walks in there, and it says one day George Washington was the first president of the United States. Now, he's never heard of George Washington, and he has no clue what it is to be a president. He just doesn't know anything about that. But dadgummit, the stall says it, and he believes it. Now compare him with a historian who has gone through congressional records in those times, newspaper articles, letters, and so on. And he also believes that George Washington was the first president. Now our two gentlemen have two things in common. What are they? They both have the same belief. And what else?
It's true.
Both of their beliefs are true. So they both have true beliefs. They know they have, they're right about what they believe. But the historian has knowledge where the Newport Beach fellow is just, I guess, lucky. Or he doesn't know why he believes it, but he happens to be right. The difference then is that the historian not only has true beliefs, but he has adequate grounds for his belief. So when you come to learn why you believe something, then you transform a true belief into knowledge. And that's what we need to do for our young brothers and sisters, and we need to start with ourselves. And I think this class is going to be a tremendous place to start, and I'm sure there are going to be recommended readings and so on where you can form groups and maybe begin to do a little reading in this. Okay, now one thing I want to say that's absolutely the most important thing I'll probably say all morning, and that is that you can have knowledge without being rationally certain. You can know something without being certain. Now, to clarify that, I want to draw a distinction between psychological psychological or spiritual certainty, and rational certainty. Now, when I say you can know something without being certain, I'm talking about rational certainty. Now, what is rational certainty? It means that it is 100% impossible that you're wrong. If you make a statement, grass is green, and you're 100% certain about it, that means the denial of that, grass is not green, is a logical contradiction. And the statement, grass is not green, is not like it's raining and not raining at the same time in the same place. So we know almost nothing with rational certainty. I certainly don't know that God exists with rational certainty. I know 2 and 2 is 4 with rational certainty. I know if P is taller than Q and Q is taller than R, then P is taller than R with rational certainty. And I know that I exist with rational certainty, and that's about it. I don't know there's an external world right now with rational certainty. I know, by the way, I know there's an external world, but I just can't be 100% certain about it. Now, what that means is that you can know things and admit you might be wrong. You can know something and still have doubts and questions that you haven't had satisfactorily answered. So this is very key, because the bar of what counts as knowledge is sometimes set way too high. And what I'm suggesting is that you can know something if you have a true belief that's based on what? Adequate, good, solid grounds. But they don't have to be certifying grounds. They don't have to make it utterly impossible you're mistaken. And so I can tell the students, you know, could I be wrong about the soul and God? Yeah, I could be wrong. I don't have any good reason to think I am. And in fact, I know God exists, because I have a true belief based on adequate reasons. But you could still have questions and doubts. Now, psychological certainty is a different deal. It's whether you feel settled about something. So I have psychological certainty at this stage of my life, so I don't pray Our Father who probably art in heaven. But I don't have rational certainty. You understand that? I don't have rational certainty, which means that I know I exist with greater certainty than I know there's a God. I know 2 and 2 is 4 with greater certainty than I know that there's a God. I mean, this is common sense. Sometimes the very thought of saying that scares Christians. They think it's somehow, I don't know. But it's the truth, and you know it. It would take a lot for somebody to talk you out of the fact that you exist. It wouldn't take quite as much to talk you out of believing in God, though I think it would take a lot. So I know God exists, because I have a true belief based on good reasons, very good reasons, but I'm still not completely 100% rationally certain, though I am completely psychologically certain. I'm set. Now, if you have emotional, this is a function of your childhood and your personality type. And if you did not have good attachment relationships with your father, you're going to be a doubter. Because the doubts are usually rooted in an inability to attach and connect and experience. So there's two kinds of doubts, emotional doubts and intellectual doubts. An intellectual doubt is something you ought to be able to put on a sheet of paper in a paragraph and write it down. An emotional doubt is something, it's just this vague sense of, I don't know, I'm just doubting this. That's usually a relational, emotional need that is addressed by therapy, not answers. But don't you dare think that there aren't such things as intellectual doubts, because there are. And we'll see this morning in church that the Bible encourages us to give answers. Now, the third kind of knowledge is know-how or skill. Know-how or skill. And that's the ability to do something well. That's the ability to do something well. My dad was one of the smartest men, using his hands and fixing things I've ever met. And I'd ask him, how did you know what was wrong with a car? He said, I don't know. You could just sort of see it. And he just saw it. I mean, I could stare at the thing for 3 weeks. He had savvy. He had know-how. You might want to call it wisdom. Okay? Now, there's such a thing as being good at life or being good at love. Or, I want to know what love is. You don't want to go to those knuckleheads for your answer. Go to 1 Corinthians 13. And it's going to, first of all, give you propositional knowledge of love. And if you read it carefully, you'll start learning to have know-how and skill in being loving. The Bible's filled with skill and know-how. Now, when I say Christianity presents knowledge, then, I am saying that its core claims, the core claims of mere Christianity, are things that you can know in all three of these ways. You can have a direct encounter with God. You can be directly aware of a moral value. It's called natural moral law. It's the knowledge of right and wrong outside the Bible that we can just be aware of it. Unless you get so screwed up like our culture that you can't see properly any longer. That does happen. We have propositional knowledge that Christ rose from the dead, that there's life after death. I just came through four cancers, three life-threatening. I had four surgeries and 7 months of chemo for 22, 23 months, and it was one of the most joy-filled, happy times of my life. I'm not kidding. And that's because I began to deal with my anxiety. And the best book, if you have a doubt about heaven, this will clear all your doubts. It's called Imagine Heaven by John Burke. You read that book and you won't doubt there's a heaven after that. Frankly, if you read the book, you probably won't want to stay around here. My wife said the reason God has not made heaven more evident is that people would be committing suicide. I'm dead serious. Because if you got down and you knew that was waiting for you, you'd think, what the heck, I'm out of here. Dead serious. Now, Christianity gives propositional knowledge and know-how. But remember, when we claim that we know that God exists because we have a true belief based on adequate reasons, we don't mean we're certain in the rational sense. We're willing to admit, hey, maybe we're wrong. Tell me why you think I am. Or what have you. But now, I'll summarize. We need to start presenting our religion to the world as a body of knowledge, doggone it, and not a body of faith, which means today, different than the biblical, it means the choice to believe something without any basis. And that's where we need to start. Now, does the Bible teach this? I hope so. And I'll be talking about that in the service. Thank you.
Dr. J.P. Moreland is going to be heading over to the service to get all mic'd up. So he will be available for a few minutes after church to chat if you guys want to just say hi to him and meet him and everything. But for now, we're just going to head over to church. We have about 15 minutes, guys. Thanks for coming. I hope you guys join us for the rest of the series.
Have a good afternoon.
Hey, Mark. I got to take my daughter. I got to take her. So, my district just approved the training. Starting July 24th, 5 months.
Give this this to him, actually.
Did you hear what Bernie Sanders said on the
I did.
That is crazy.
It is. I couldn't believe it. So, yeah, but I think his church was going to be just as good. So, it was so good. Such a great time. Wow. Excuse me. I got to give Nathaniel this back. Hey, sorry I'm rushing. I gotta give Nathaniel's phone back. It's still recording. Glad you're here, dude. It was a really good equipping hour, huh?
Yeah, it was.
Yep, just wait till the service.
Yeah.
Get even more, man. He's preaching. Hey.
Morning.
It's still recording. I didn't know how to turn it off.
Thanks.